Greetings, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's a preview of what's coming up next on your trusted radio station. Up first, take a moment for thoughtful reflection with Hadith of the Day. Next, we turn to Islamic laws with Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of the prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Following that, join us for Africa Today. For those seeking to deepen their connection with the Holy Quran, don't miss Let's Recite the Quran. Coming up next, it's the Hadith of the Day. Stay tuned.
Oh, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the Day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more. No more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today we reflect on a profound saying of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny. It's quoted that he swore by Allah and said, "By the one in whose hand is my soul, none shall enter paradise except the merciful." The companion said, "We are all merciful." He replied, "Not just that. You must show mercy to all people." So this hadith expands the meaning of mercy from a personal feeling to a way of life, as you can see. We often think of mercy as something we show to our children, parents, or friends, but the Holy Prophet is teaching us that mercy must extend beyond our circle to neighbors, strangers, and even those who disagree with us, all in a different way. And psychology supports this. Studies show that compassion reduces stress and increases happiness, not only for the receiver, but also for the giver. Mercy is contagious. It spreads peace in families, workplaces, and communities. The Prophet's emphasis on the Ummah, this hadith, the general public, is remarkable. It means kindness to people you may never meet again. The shopkeeper, the bus driver, the refugee, the orphan, anyone. Imagine a city where people treat even strangers with patience and care. Research in psychology, sociology, confirms that societies with higher levels of public trust and compassion enjoy greater safety and prosperity. Mercy to the public is not just spiritual, it's practical nation building. History gives us shining examples. During famines, Imam Ali alayhi salam would personally carry food on his back to poor families at night. Mercy to the Ummah. And even to non-Muslims, we should care for the dignity and be kind to them in a certain way. For example, guiding the ignorant, guiding those who are misguided, guiding those who are not religious in the correct way, in the correct meaning, is a sort of mercy. These examples show us that mercy is not selective. It's a universal principle that elevates us all. So how can we bring this hadith to life today? Start with a small act, a smile to a stranger holding the door or speaking kindly. all our examples, and expand your circle. Show care beyond family and friends. Support community projects, help refugees, and visit the sick, feed the hungry, and so on. Be merciful in power. If you are a teacher, employer, or parent, practice patience and understanding. True strength lies in gentleness. And check your heart. Ask, is my mercy limited only to those I love, or does it embrace humanity, as the Prophet taught? Inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli
English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hussein's program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Alaikum salam, rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We have been discussing some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'd like to continue along the same line by asking you this question at the beginning of this session. Sheikh Javid, in some project, the employer's agent asks the contractor for an amount of money as sweets.
Right.
If the latter refuses, it may lead to some kinds of obstacles or losses to the contractor. What is the contractor's duty in such cases?
Well, paying and receiving such money is not permissible. And in these cases, you may take legal actions, or maybe you need to, if there is any possibility that the agent might want to harm you, or that he could create problem, then you may resort to legal solutions if the things do not work out.
I see. Well, I'm going to ask you something about the congregational prayer.
Yes.
When the imam of the prayer is in ruku, all right, or genuflection, a person starts his prayer and bows to ruku. Then he doubts whether or not he has reached imam's ruku. What rule actually applies to this prayer?
Well, in the state of doubt, the position is this, that his prayer is valid,
mm-hmm.
but he should continue his prayer individually,
right?
Because he's not sure that he reached the imam while he was in his ruku. He was not certain. So, of course, he made his niyyah, and then he should continue his prayer in the state or in as farada, not as in jama'ah.
I see. Okay, well, another question would be regarding, in fact, having a second house.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you whether it's prone to or subject to khums or not. If someone buys a second house in place other than his hometown,
right,
or a primary area of residence to spend, for example, let's say summers or holidays or vacations there, is he obliged or obligated to pay khums on the value of the second house?
Well, it depends on whether he needs the second house or not. Did he buy that second house for investment purpose or for his own needs?
Mm-hmm.
So, if in the common perception of the general public, the second house is deemed as his need, okay, he is not liable for khums.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just like the example you gave, you said that, okay, maybe he buys a house, for example, in the winter, for his winter vacation, he goes there, he stays there for 1 or 2 months, he needs it, okay,
mm-hmm.
when he goes to a city which is even colder in the summer season. So he has two houses which he needs at the same time. Of course, from the perspective of common people or general public, both of those houses are his house, which he needs. And if, for example, the second house is deemed to be a luxury item,
mm-hmm.
yes, it is subject to khums. He has to pay 1/5 of its market value as khums.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, the believers are, sometimes you can see them in the mosque or some other places, who are incapable of performing their prostrations of the canonic prayers in their normal form.
Right.
Let's say due to old age, senility, or physical impairment and difficulty. These
right.
believers typically sit on a chair and perform their prostrations by placing their heads on a table in front of them. First of all, does this count as a valid prostration? And second, how should they position the seven body parts integral to the validity of a proper prostration?
Right. Well, if those who are incapable of performing the sujood in its standard form,
yes,
can bend over and place their heads on a table in front of them, they should do so. And of course, this would constitute the proper prostration or the proper sajda for them. Yeah. When it comes to the position of the seven body parts involved in sajda, of course, they should, as far as possible, observe the proper position or the closest position thereto. Okay, making sure that all seven parts are on the floor during sajda, if possible, as far as possible. Allah, la yukallifullahu nafsan illa wus'aha. Allah does not obligate a person beyond their capacity. So when it's not possible, it's not possible. So it's not necessary to worry. And likewise, it's not permissible for those who can place their heads on a table in front of them to place the turba on their forehead using their hands. That's not possible. But obviously, they are absolved of the requirement to place their knees on the ground, as the assumption is that they have to be seated on a chair, because they cannot, for example, people who, for example, cannot stand, they have to sit on a chair. And people who cannot sit on a chair, or they cannot do sajda on the turba placed on the table,
yes,
they can sit down on the floor or maybe lie down with their backs. But it depends on what they can, okay? So depending on their excuse, of course. For a person who can sit, the placing the knees on the ground is absolved. He cannot do it.
Yes. And the other seven integral parts,
yeah, the
basically?
The foot is that the feet are placed.
Yes.
The hands are placed on the table.
Yes.
Okay. And then the forehead. So five organs are placed on the, yeah, you can say on the ground.
Excluding the knees.
Excluding the knees, yes.
Yes. Thank you very much, Shachawit. Let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. صلي على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are speaking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is it valid to join a congregational prayer when the congregants are in the final tashahud of the prayer?
Right. Well, if the worshipper arrives at a congregational prayer when the imam is reciting the final tashahud, in order to receive the reward of participating in the jama'at prayer, one is allowed to say the takbiratul ihram and then immediately proceed to sit and recite the tashahud along with the imam of the jama'ah or congregation, stopping short of uttering the final salam or taslim, because he has just joined the prayer. He cannot do the taslim along with the imam, of course. And when the imam is finished with the salam, the worshipper should proceed to stand up and, without repeating the intention and commencing takbir of the prayer, he should recite Surah Al-Hamd and the second surah as constituting the qara'ah of the first rak'ah of the prayer. So it will be counted as the first rak'ah, because he has to recite hamd and surah and then proceed to the ruku' and sujood, and again he has to stand up and do the and recite hamd and surah. So after he will gain the reward of the jama'at prayer, but then when the jama'at prayer ends, he will continue his prayer as farada, individual prayer.
I see. Sheikh Chaubi, does testimony concerning the wilaya of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, peace be upon him, in the tashahud, invalidate the prayers?
Well, this issue has begun to emerge in the subcontinent, Indian subcontinent. There are some people who want to sow seeds of differences and disunity among Shia Muslims by raising up this issue and creating doubts on the minds of the people, telling so-called scholars, telling that it is permissible to add to the prayer what is not part of the prayer. Like, for example, the wilaya of Imam Ali should be added to the prayer because it is an essential, very fundamental belief in the Shia Islam. Of course, there are many fundamental beliefs. We have no right whatsoever to add to the prayer what's not part of the prayer. That's what we call bid'ah, okay?
Right.
Every right, every fundamental issue that we believe in cannot be added to the prayer, because the prayer has its own shape and form, structure, which came to us and from the time of the Prophet. Now, in this time and age, we have no right to add to the prayer something which is not part of the prayer. So, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, the prayer, including the tashahhud, should be recited in the same way as the maraji of the religious authorities, the maraji al-taqlid, have mentioned in their books of Tawzih al-Masail, Practical Laws of Islam, and one should not add anything to it, even if it's true, even if it's correct.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Chaubi. And thank you, my dear audience, for joining your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chaubi, our guest speaker. And the topic we have had in this episode was some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Shines above, you're the reason I never give up. You're the one I try for, live my life for, give up all I have. You're the melody, you're the key, all the inspiration I need. And when times get tough, I know you'll stand by me. You are the love I need, the one who is God. And you know my destiny, for you are the light, and you are my life. Oh, 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 oh. Oh, 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 oh
stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the U.S. closes doors, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs war imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the global south. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Irete Bakara Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view this as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize The only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chibuka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration. Basically, because Africa is the richest continent on earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales. But if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, etc. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as food, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. Integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chibuka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs, to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AfCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOAP. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA, really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly, we should get away. And I can't say, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually, they need the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. And must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
I definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states. And also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So their relationship with China has always been a positive and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that are have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.?
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was a reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms, so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive, because the writing, the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust, or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to respond effectively, while some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes. Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on the until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa, and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education, because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya, who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guest today, Irechi Bakare Yusuf and Zizwe Chibuka, for their incisive analysis. Now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant agricultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Janatali, will share more on this.
Hello, I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. Songhai Empire, one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Asfia Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system built on Islamic law. Under Asfia Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade, dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. In 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tondibi marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Janet Ali, it's goodbye for now.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
فتعود
let's recite the Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum, brother Mahdi. Thank you for having me, and assalamu alaikum to all the dear listeners of this program. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, the program Let's Recite the Quran consists of several Quranic parts. First, Brother Muhammad is going to talk about the music or the musical miracle of the Noble Quran. Then, we all are going to listen to a recitation by a famous reciter of the Noble Quran. And at the end, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation from different aspects. Stay tuned. Well, as always, in the first part of the program, let's recite the Quran. Brother Muhammad will talk about the miraculous music of the Noble Quran. We are talking about the semantic relationship between the words. Now, Brother Muhammad, the mic is yours.
So we were talking about words that are related to each other, and they come in groups. You have groups of words which are very close in meaning. For example, we gave the example of the verse, أَلَهُمْ أَرْجُلٌ يَمْشُونَ بِهَا.
Yeah, parts of the body, actually.
Yeah, the parts of the body and the action of that body. What does it do? We walk with our feet. What do we do? We hold something with our hands. We see with our eyes and so on and so forth. Now I'm going to talk about something that's a little different. It's actually words that are opposites.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes opposites also are very relevant to each other. Okay, they are related, but at the same time, they're actually quite the opposite.
Just like night and day.
Night and day, exactly. We have a lot of these kinds of verses in the Holy Quran, and it makes the verses of Quran very beautiful. For example, what does Allah say in Surah Fatir, verses 19 to 22? This is a very beautiful verse. These groups of verses are actually very beautiful. وَمَا يَسْتَوِي الْأَعْمَى وَالْبَصِيرُ
أَعْمَى.
A person who is blind is not the same as someone who can see.
Mm-hmm. They're not equal.
Allah is making a point here. So yes, the point Allah is making is that they're not equal. A person, for example, who can see is not like a person who is blind. Darkness and light are not the same.
And the same is true for Nur and Lulma.
Darkness and light. The next pair is وَلَلْظِلُّ وَلَلْحَرُورُ. Shade and heat of the sun are not the same either. It's either opposites again. وَمَا يَسْتَوِي الْأَحْيَاءُ وَلَلْأَمْوَاتِ. The ones who are living and those that are dead, they're not the same. إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُسْمِعُ مَنْ يَشَاءُ. Allah can make any that He wills to hear. Okay? Allah can make anyone that He wants, that He wills to hear. وَمَا أَنْتَ بِمُسْمِعٍ مَنْ فِي الْقُبُورِ. إِنْ أَنْتَ إِلَّا نَذِيرٌ. You are just a warner. إِنَّ This is, Allah is addressing the Prophet. إِنَّا أَرْسَلْنَاكَ بِالْحَقِّ بَشِيرًا وَنَذِيرًا وَإِنْ مِنْ أُمَّةٍ إِلَّا خَلَى فِيهَا نَذِيرًا.
So this we're talking about the beautiful pairs.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you pay attention to the rhyme, you will see that they are again the same.
Yeah, they're also the rhymes.
Yeah. The two first pairs, I think, have the same rhyme.
Actually, the second and third one.
Yeah, that's right.
And then at the end, وَمَا أَنْتَ بِمُسْمِعٍ مَنْ فِي الْقُبُورِ.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad. Dear audience, we'll be right back after a short break. Stay tuned. Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now in the second part of the program, let's recite the Quran. We all are going to listen to the recitation of verses 1 to 6 of Surah At-Tin, recited by Brother Hamid Shakir Nejad. Let's enjoy it.